Welcome, everyone. If you have interest in hearing how you make the move from a corporate job to becoming a leader in the multifamily investing space, you are going to want to hear what Zach Haptonstall has to say. Zach was a live TV news anchor and sports reporter and made the successful leap into large-scale multifamily. And get this, he's still in his 20s. On to the intro.
Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing, be introduced to the players that are getting it done, and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
A little background on Zach Haptonstall before we start the show. Zach has always been self-motivated. He graduated college summa cum laude. Sounds impressive, right? I actually had to look it up. It means with highest praise. I think I recall him telling me he made straight A's. He became a live television news anchor and sports reporter, which sounds pretty cool to many of us, right? But at the end of the day, it's a corporate job and he's working to make other people wealthy. Zach then takes charge of his life, educates himself, and goes after large-scale multifamily. He's a general partner in 5 properties in the Phoenix area with a total asset value of over $48 million. He's done all of this and he's still in his 20s. Just imagine what Zach can achieve in the next 5 or 10 years. Now, on to the show. Hey, everybody. We have Zach Haptonstall here with us today, and I am so excited to have him because I have so many people reach out to me that are younger, looking to get into the large-scale multifamily business. Zach is in his 20s. He's figured out a way to do it. So just want to welcome Zach. Zach, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Dan. Really appreciate it. I know we met a couple of years ago at a conference and we've become pretty good friends at that time. So thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're a leader especially for the young guys, but even myself, I'm a 50-year-old and I'm having to chase you as well. So I appreciate you coming on the show. Hey, we're going to get into more details on the multifamily side, but just a high level recap of what you've done so far on the multifamily side. I believe you're at 5 properties and like 420 units. Is that where it stands today?
That's correct. Yeah. We've acquired 5 assets and 420 units, which was about $48 million of assets purchased. So
that's crazy. And that's in what time period? Like 2 or 3 years?
Well, so we closed on the first deal. Actually, it was February of last year, 2019. So in about 15, 16 months, we've acquired, we did those 5 assets actually. We closed on the first one in February of 19 and the last one we closed in March of 2020. So really in 13 months, as far as acquiring them. However, I spent, and we can talk about this, Darren, whatever you want to talk about, but I spent over 10 months of making no money, grinding it out, trying to figure out multifamily before getting the first deal under contract. And that first deal took 4 months just to close. And then we kind of caught momentum after that.
That's amazing. That is amazing. So, hey, before we get into the multifamily space, what was your career path prior to that?
Yeah. So I was born and raised here in Phoenix. Okay. I originally wanted to be a football player. So I had a football scholarship to a school in Colorado. And then I wasn't good enough to go to the NFL, Darren. So I came back.
What position?
Believe it or not, I was an offensive tackle. In high school, I was 220. I was an undersized offensive tackle and I was all state and all that. And all the other all state guys went D1. I went D2. I was too small. I got up to 280, believe it or not.
I cannot believe that. Listeners, if you see a picture of Zach, you will be as shocked as I am that he was an offensive tackle. So
I know.
You don't weigh 280 pounds now.
I'm about 220 right now. So yeah. Back to a comfortable weight. But yeah, so anyway, so I I decided that wasn't for me, kept getting injured. And I was like, oh, this is no fun. So I wanted to be a sports reporter. So I went to Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State, and I got a journalism degree. And I was a live news anchor on Arizona PBS for a short time. And a sports reporter. I hosted a show on Fox Sports Network, Arizona, on TV, which was pretty cool. And then I quickly realized, Darren, that you work crazy hours. You don't make very much money. It's very political. It's not what I thought I was going to get into.
That's crazy because, first of all, I didn't know that that was your background, that you were a sports host. And, you know, for a lot of men, I mean, that's a dream job, you know, to be broadcasting sports. But you say that, you know, once you got into it, you realized that there was a small minority of people that really made it to the top and really made any serious money.
100%. Yeah. You have to be like a primetime evening news anchor in like LA, New York, Chicago to make real big money. I mean, even the top guys in Phoenix were making like 120K. It's not what you would think. So anyways, it's when you're a fan, it's different as when it becomes a job. It wasn't fun. So I was like, I don't want to do this. I had a bunch of school debt and I was like, I need to make money. So I had graduated. I decided not to pursue journalism, did not go that route. I was 21. At the time, I was delivering medical equipment nights and weekends while I was going to school to pay for it. And my boss was like, hey, you can make pretty good money doing healthcare marketing. So my goal was just work a year or two in healthcare to try to make money, pay off my debt and figure it out. So of all things, Darren, I got a job as a hospice marketer. So I don't know if you're familiar with hospice care, but it's
I'm familiar with it a little bit at the high level, but go ahead and give us a little bit of feedback.
Yeah. So basically this is a service that it's covered. It's free for people through their Medicare and it's a mobile service. It's nursing and caregiving who sees patients with terminal illnesses at private homes, assisted living, wherever they may live. My job was to wake up in the morning, drive all around Phoenix and just walk in cold calling to hospitals, doctor's offices, assisted living, et cetera, build relationships with physicians, social workers, nurses. And when they had somebody who needed hospice care, they call me. I'm the first person to reach out to the family and educate them on the resources. And if they would like that care, get them signed up. So it sounds kind of weird, Darren. And I know it sounds kind of grim, right? But it's an extremely lucrative and competitive private business industry where these are all private companies. Phoenix is the number one market in the country for hospice care. Florida is second. It's just like you would think. It's sunny. There's
right.
a lot of priorities.
Makes sense, right?
Yep. And so basically you're signing people up and you're billing. Essentially, the federal government is reimbursing you. And so, I was blessed to do very well at a young age. You know, I connected well with that. And in all humility, I was probably the top marketer in the entire valley here. Out of hundreds, if not thousands. So, I mean, I come from like a lower middle-class family. So my parents never had a lot of money. By the time I was 23, I was making six figures. I was making more money than both my parents combined. I bought a house when I was 24. I had started my MBA. So I went to night school, got my MBA, and I paid for that cash. By the time I was like 24, I had an MBA, I had no debt, I had a house, I was very blessed. And by the time I was 25, I was making over 200K a year. So
holy
I was
cow.
Doing very well. I started out as a marketer, I became the director of marketing, so managing a team, and then I became a co-owner in the company. And then I just kind of got to the point where I was just feeling burnt out and I didn't know what the next challenge was. You know, I had kind of like, I was like quote unquote dominating this little space that I had, making pretty good money, but I was getting taxed heavily on commissions, right? And there's always a lot of pressure. And so I was just like, I'm not happy doing this. So I found out the company was going to sell. And this was the beginning of 2018. So January 2018, I said, screw it. I don't want to do this anymore. I resigned. I sold my equity to these guys. And this was just a sister company, okay? So I mean, I don't want to make light of it, but I really only made about 250K or so, which is not bad, but it's not in the grand scheme. It's not, you're not going to retire off that, right? So I didn't know what I was going to do, Darren, but I decided I want to find a way to create freedom of my time and create passive income. And I did not have any kids. I don't have any kids yet. Grace and I plan to have many kids, but we were in a fortunate position where I said, I'm going to live off savings for the next 12 months. I'm going to figure out how to do that somehow through real estate.
So Zach, let me ask you this. I mean, you're 25 years old. First of all, that was incredibly impressive. And it's obvious that you're a go-getter, you know, even before you got involved in real estate. But at 25, I'm just going to be real. There's not a lot of people that are thinking to themselves, you know, how do I create passive income? So how did you even get that mindset? Were you reading different books or?
Yeah, that's a great question, Darren, because I was like, okay, I want to keep moving forward. And I was dominating, getting good bonuses, but in sales, it's like, what have you done for me lately? Right. So it was like a never ending cycle. So I truly did feel like I was in a rat race, even at a young age. And I know some people might laugh. They're like, yo, you're 25, 26, but I wanted to go to the next level and I wanted to figure out how to get there. And I realized I couldn't do that. And it was December of 2017. It was a Christmas party at Grace, who was then my girlfriend, now my fiance. It was at her family's Christmas party. I met this guy. I was like, what do you do? And he owned mobile home parks here in Phoenix. And I just started talking to this guy. And I had gotten my real estate license a couple years prior, but I had never used it. So I knew nothing about real estate. That was literally all I knew, was I had that license and I never used it.
Right.
And he's like, you should read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So as the cliche story goes, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. It kind of sparked a little bit. And I was like, I could just buy mobile home parks and screw this healthcare thing. Like, I could just have money coming to me and I don't have to always be hustling. It'll free up my time to pursue other things. So that's when the light kind of went on. And the next month I resigned and I sold the equity, and I had no plan at all, but I was like, I'm going to go buy mobile home parks. So,
but you know, that's awesome that you ended up, one, you were looking for something, you were searching for something.
For at least a year and a half. Yeah. It was not just, I just didn't know what I wanted to do, but I wasn't happy.
And then, you know, you found somebody at a party that, you know, sounded like he was a successful guy, asked him what he did. And all of a sudden it sparked a trigger, you know, to try to go after something else. And, you know, that's, you did this, the two steps you got to do. I mean, you have to go searching for it first and then somehow get educated. And you did just that. So that's fantastic. So why didn't you do mobile home parks then? Because you ended up doing multifamily.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Good question. So, I mean, I didn't know anything about real estate, mind you. So like, this is all new to me. I don't have like a rich uncle or anybody who's in the industry. I just knew this one guy and I was kind of picking his brain. And he just asked me, he told me to start reading books. So I read like Ken McElroy, like ABCs of Property Management, ABCs of Real Estate Investing. And I started consuming all the books I could. I started listening to podcasts like yours, Darren, to try to learn more about it. And I cold called over 90 mobile home park owners in the Phoenix Metro. And so I created like a little system where I would go on public record and see which entity owned it. And then I bought a subscription to like one of these data mining. This is all legal, by the way, but like a data mining company, and it like penetrates the corporate veil and it finds the phone number. And so I created a spreadsheet. I just start cold calling all these park owners to see if they want to sell. And out of like over a little over 90 of them, I think six of them answered. All of them except one said like, leave me alone. They're all in California. One guy was going to sell on a seller carry. And I thought it was a good deal. And I got analysis paralysis for like 2 or 3 weeks and I was terrified. And then somebody else got it. So anyways, long story short, I spent the first 3 months, Darren, just focused on mobile home parks, trying to learn about real estate, property management, et cetera, et cetera. And I started to realize that the mobile home parks are just as overpriced as the multifamily. Okay. And I was only thinking my money at that time. Okay. I was thinking, I'm going to use this money. I had like 260K roughly to just deploy. And I was going to go all in and just manage something myself and figure it out. But then I started to learn about syndication. I can't remember if it was through a podcast or what, but the lights kind of clicked for me when I associated syndication and multifamily. Okay. Cause I came from healthcare, so I had a network of physicians and healthcare business owners who also hated their lives like I used to, because they have no time, right? And they have a lot of money, but they have families and stuff. So I was like, well, maybe they'll be interested in investing with me if I can make them this appeal to them. And apartments are a lot more attractive asset class than mobile home parks. Obviously mobile home parks have a very negative connotation, and people outside of real estate, they don't understand that it's like, can be a positive thing. You know what I mean? They don't think it's
absolutely. So you mentioned syndication, and obviously I'm familiar with that term, and probably a lot of the listeners are also familiar, but there, I would imagine there's also listeners that they're just like you were, you know, a year or two ago, where they're just trying to learn about real estate. And I think that word can be intimidating, syndication. So what does that really mean?
I know it sounds like a mafia term or something, right? Yeah. No, I didn't know either. And so, I can't remember where I learned it, but it was through a podcast or something. And so basically the way I explain syndication is it's similar to like crowdfunding, right? It's where I find a deal and I'll put some of my own money in the deal, but I need to partner with several investors who will invest their money into the deal. And they're all going to own a pro rata percentage of that deal, pro rata to what they invest, but they're going to be silent or passive. And I, as the quote unquote syndicator or sponsor, am active and am responsible for sourcing the deal, acquiring it, raising the capital, and then just executing the business plan. Okay. And we can talk about that too. So basically I'm active and I get sweat equity, if you will, in the deal for doing all that. So that was appealing to me, Darren, because I learned about leverage with not only a loan, but making my money go further by gaining sweat equity in a larger asset.
Completely makes sense. And, you know, I would sum it up. Syndication is just, you know, a bunch of people coming together and pooling their money to buy a larger asset that they could buy on their own. And that's what you figured out. You could actually buy a larger asset and make more money by doing that. So,
100%. Yep.
So now you decide you want to go down multifamily syndication. Is that when you ended up joining the same mentorship group that we're part of, or how did you get involved with that?
Yeah, good question. So I was kind of doing like the shiny object syndrome, right? Because I was learning about real estate and I was like, oh, mobile home parks, multifamily, self storage, and it's easy to jump all around. But I told myself, you need to choose one. They're all really hard to get into. So it's easy when you're like trying to get into this and you're like, well, that's too hard, or that's overpriced, that's competitive. I'll just try to find the next easier. What's the next thing? But you have to find an asset class in a market that you truly believe in, and you have to grind it out. And so for me, I started to realize that, okay, I don't want to be going out of state, especially for the first deal. Phoenix is a good multifamily market. I believe in multifamily. I need to set my sights on that. And so before, this was at least about three or four months before I ever met you, Darren, and joined that mentorship group, I had decided I'm all out multifamily syndication. So what I started to do is I was like, okay, well, I can read all these books and all these podcasts all I want, but if I don't actually get out there and start building a team, I'm not going to get anywhere. And it was terrifying for me, okay? Because and I was like a sales guy. I'm used to walking into hospitals, which is scary too, and just talking to doctors. But this was terrifying because these are big numbers. They're big buildings, and I felt like I didn't belong. But what I realized, I need to build a team. So what I did, I remember I got this from Ken McElroy's ABCs of Real Estate Investing. I looked up what are called AMOs, Accredited Management Organizations, on irem.org, irem.org. This is a website that shows you accredited property management companies. And what I did is I went on there and I found 5 property manager companies in Phoenix that are accredited, and I reached out to them. I looked up their websites, I called them, emailed them, and I kind of had to fake it till I make it because you want people to take you seriously. So I said, hey, I'm Zach. I have a healthcare background. I have several physicians who want to invest and we're looking to partner with a property manager company. We're going to scale up, et cetera, et cetera. I was trying to appeal to them to partner so that they would actually care.
Sure.
So I set up these 5 meetings, and I literally created, this is going to sound like overkill, but I created 10 pages of double-spaced questions for property manager companies that kind of vet accounting processes, operational processes, what's your communication like, et cetera, et cetera. And I learned this all from just reading books and stuff. You know, some of it sounds probably like nerdy now, like if I were to talk to a property manager company, but.
Well, what I was thinking was it sounds like you're very thorough and detail oriented.
Yeah, my biggest fear was coming across as like a rookie, you know, which you can't fear because you have to get in somewhere, but it is important to try to sound credible and learn the language so that people will take you seriously and spend the time. So anyways, what I did, Darren, I met with these companies, I vetted all these people, and then I asked them at the end, I said, hey, do you know any lenders in the market who are good? And do you know any brokers? And do you know any attorneys? In every single meeting I had with those property manager companies, they all referred me to lenders, brokers, attorneys, et cetera. Okay. And so that's what I did. And then I started to meet with them. I started to meet the lenders and ask them for referrals and et cetera, et cetera. And this was terrifying again. Like I was shaking, but you just fake it till you make it.
Well, let me ask you this. You were scared, but the first meeting with one of the property management companies was probably scarier than the second one. And
correct.
Then the third one. And the first meeting with the lender was more scary than the second one, because you start to learn what questions they're going to ask you back, and you're sizing them up, but they're also sizing you up. So you learn from that experience. And so each time you do it, you get more and more confident.
100%. Yep. Very well said. You start to learn what to expect and you realize these are just people, right? It's just a different industry. There's different language and I just need to become comfortable and feel like I belong in this industry. So that's what people need to do. They have to get out there and don't be afraid to fail, because the worst thing is you look stupid and who cares, right? I mean, you're not going to see these people. They don't matter. And so basically I did that. And then I was referred to a guy, one of the property management companies, like, look, we only do 100 plus units. I'll refer you to a guy who does sub 50 units. And I said, okay, well, maybe that makes more sense. I meet with this guy for an hour, and he had a property management company, and we ended the meeting. An hour later, he calls me and he says, hey, I kind of like what you're doing. He's like, what I didn't tell you is, yeah, I own this property management company, but I'm also an investor myself and I buy smaller deals. How would you like to partner with me? You find the deal and raise some capital and I'll manage it and lend my expertise. So it's this guy, Tom. And just like that, it was like a miracle for me.
That's incredible.
And I was like so excited because I'm like, now I have a guy who kind of believes in me, so to speak, and who wants to partner. So this is before I ever joined the mentorship program, Darren. And I was bouncing everything off this guy, Tom. And ultimately, I ended up partnering with him for the first deal along with our fellow mentorees in that deal. But it just goes to show you just have to kind of network and get out there. And if you're hungry, people will respect that and appreciate that.
But yeah, I completely agree. And I have so many people that I've talked to that reached out to me on Instagram, and they almost talk themselves out of, you know, whether they're worthy enough and have value to add to somebody else. And here you are, you know, you're 20 something, you know, obviously a go-getter, right? And you've got some capital. It's not like you didn't have any capital at all. You had some capital.
And to that point, I don't want to interrupt you, Darren. To that point, I forgot to say, I literally brought a proof of funds bank statement with me to all the broker meetings just to show people I'm for real.
Right.
You don't have to do that, but that was my edge, I thought. You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, some people have the capital, some people don't, but like play up to your strengths and then trying to find partners, you know, that can marry up with you. And some people think to themselves, well, why would an experienced person want to work with me? Well, you know, this guy, Tom, you know, what was the value that you brought to him? Well, you could go out and raise capital and help him get more deals than he can get on his own. And so it was a win-win scenario.
100%. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like, what value can you bring into him to go, I got this young guy who's going to go out and meet with all these brokers, maybe he doesn't want to do that, right? And I told him I've got a network of people. I don't actually know if I can raise money, but I'll try, right? And so, and I told him that too. I said, I've never done it, but I think that I can do it. And I've got money. So it's like, whatever you need me to do, I'll do. And people will respect that if you can appeal to them.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I would imagine you probably talked a little bit about your success in the healthcare field and that you had a lot of relationships in that field, whether it be with physicians or owners of these different establishments. And so that was appealing. You didn't know for sure that they were going to invest with you, but talking about your potential network, you know, that your contacts and your network, it can be powerful.
Yep. 100%. You have to sell people on you and your value.
So another thing I heard that you did in the Phoenix market was that you started up your own meetup group. So help me understand, one, what was the motivation for setting up that meetup group? And then two, kind of what were some of the challenges with getting that thing established?
Yeah, good question. So Grace and I, we had looked at different meetups. I wanted to kind of just, when I first started, I joined my local RIA as RIA. And
Single family.
Yeah, and it was terrible. Yeah, it's right. A joke. I mean, no right. offense to those guys, but it's not what you want. You know what I mean? And so, and I would go to different meetups and they were crap. They were not organized and there was no quality people. And a lot of the times the host didn't even show up to them. So it was just like, man, where do you go to even find people who are doing this? And it just makes you doubt your ability to enter the industry even more because you think that these apartment investors are rich people in ivory towers that don't talk to common folk, right? And so, So it was kind of twofold. It was like we wanted to have an organized meetup where we could really provide value. And we wanted to kind of educate people and bring people together. Okay. So we really wanted to bring together professionals, and it came from truly an organic point where our intentions were truly organic. Whereas if we can provide value and bring real estate professionals together, then maybe the residual effect will be that we'll develop relationships with brokers, potential investors, and different professionals. And so that was the biggest thing. And that was terrifying too, by the way, because you like don't know who's going to show up and you don't want to look stupid or waste people's time. And there's a lot of doubt that goes into it, but we just kind of did it, you know? So when we didn't know what we were doing, there was no template. There was no book or podcast. I was just kind of thinking, I was like, well, if I can just get, this was after we had done our first deal. Okay. So I think there's power in that where you have, once you get to do that first deal, for me, it was like getting a monkey off my back. And it's like, now I'm in the club, right? Like right. Now I belong and I'm an actual real estate investor, you know? So that's big because most people haven't done a deal. So that gave me a lot of confidence to start a meetup because you feel like you can at least share your experience of going through the process of the first acquisition and that can provide value. But what I did is, I didn't want to do like a case study or anything like that. I wanted to have like an open forum where people could actually ask questions. So I invited our lender on the first deal. I invited the owner of our property management company, our insurance broker, and our transactional attorney. And fortunately, they all said, yeah, I'll do it. So we just had them all up there in the front of the room. And we had like 20 to 30 people, fortunately, show up to that first one, which is a testament to Grace and all her marketing prowess. But we just did like an open mic where I had a bunch of questions that were, I had pre-written down. I emailed the respective questions to each person ahead of time so they knew what to expect so they didn't feel uncomfortable. And it was kind of like you and I are doing right now, Darren, where I would just set up there in front of people and ask them the questions and ask them to elaborate. And then the crowd can raise their hands. And that was kind of the format. And so we started that in April of 2019. We had like a little over 20 people and we just kept doing it every month. And we just kept getting different speakers and we got more prolific or well-known speakers to fly in, which was kind of cool. Wow. And we've done some different formats. But yeah, we did an event in December. We had Rod Khalif fly in and we had like over 120 people, which was really cool. So
That's fantastic. You know, and even that first one, if you think about that first one that you had, obviously there was a lot of fear, you know, is anybody going to show up? But, you know, 20 or 30 people showed up and it was, if you think about it, it's really a win-win for everybody, right? So these 20 or 30 people show up, they don't really know what to expect, but now they have a lender that talks to them. They Yep. have a broker that talks to them. They have an insurance guy that talks to them. And most likely, if they were very interested in multifamily, they learned something that night. Now, the win-win for all those partners that you brought in is, look, if somebody in the audience all of a sudden decides to go invest in a multifamily deal, they're going to remember that lender and Yep. they may call them to do the loan on the deal. So it's a win-win.
Which has happened. These guys have gotten a lot of referrals. I've referred so many people to our attorney. So yeah, exactly.
That's fantastic. And it, you know, it goes both ways. You know, you keep on making referrals and then you never know when they're going to say, hey, you need to talk to Zach and maybe it's a business partner or maybe it's a seller looking to sell something off market. You just never know. So that Yep. that's fantastic that you've grown that. Now I know that you, that first deal, how was that structured? Was that a syndication or was that structured differently?
It was a tenant in common.
So that was a lot of people call that a tick.
A
tenant in common. So explain to the listeners, what's the difference between a tenant in common and a syndication?
Yeah, good question, Darren. So a syndication is when you are, so basically when you accept somebody's money who is passive in a deal, they do not play an active role. That is legally a security. And you are now subject to the regulations of the Security and Exchange Commission, the SEC. Which is in order to have a security, it's a ton of paperwork, very complex. So what the SEC allows you to do is you can file for exemptions to do a syndication. Okay, so in the case of multifamily syndication, the most common exemption which allows you to do this and not have to file as a security is what's called Regulation D506. Okay. So there's B and C. So basically the difference is with a syndication, let's just say it's you and I, Darren, and we're partnering. We're going to have passive investors that we are raising capital from. And the passive, they are signing legal documentations, essentially saying that they're going to be completely passive, hands off. They have no decision making. And you and I are going to run the show and we're going to make the decisions. Whereas in a tenant in common, there are no passive investors. Every member of the deal in a tenant in common is legally active. Okay. And so that's the primary difference, is that the tenant in common, you have everybody in the deal as active partners. And let's just say we do a tenant in common. All right, Darren, let's just say it's $1 million equity check is what we need. And you bring in 900K of your own cash and I bring 100K. Well, you're going to own 90% of the deal and I'm going to own 10% of the deal. But we have to have unanimous voting on everything, regardless of how much we own. Okay. So it's a little bit different structure. And so when you're doing a tenant in common, we could do it where it's just the two of us and each of us can be considered a tenant in common. Okay. So for asset protection purposes, you don't want to just buy it in your own name. You want to create like Darren LLC. Okay. So your Darren LLC will be one tenant in common. That's a tick. That's one tick LLC. And I'll create mine, Zach LLC, tick LLC. So now you have these two tick LLCs and their tenants in common. So both of those LLCs, the managers of those LLCs, have to unanimously vote on all decisions. Okay. And so there's different legal paperwork as compared to a syndication.
So, you know, active versus non-active, you know, with the passive investors, you know, it fits well for somebody that doesn't really want to go out and search for the deal, doesn't want to manage the deal, but they have excess cash. They want to put it to work. They like the idea of being involved in real estate. They don't want all their money in the stock market. So they invest as a passive investor in the type of deal. Now, versus the tick, everybody that's part of that plays an active role. And if there's three partners and two of them want to sell and one doesn't want to sell, you know, 5 years down the road, then it's very difficult because you have to have a unanimous vote, where that's not the case on the syndication side. So you did the first deal as a tenant in common. And then after that, was your second deal structured the same way or did you do a syndication?
Yeah, good question. So we did the first deal, we did a tenant in common. Our next deal was actually a portfolio of two deals that we were buying at the same time. There was a 59 unit and a 76 unit. And we actually did both to answer your question. The next deal was, it was one escrow, two deals, right? But two separate loans. On the 59 unit, we did a tenant in common. The 76 unit, we did a syndication. So we kind of combined both strategies and it actually underwrote better that way. So it actually benefited us to have the tenant in common experience because the seller was more likely to sell both assets to somebody rather than he was willing to sell them one off, but he wanted to sell them both. And right. We made them both pencil because we just applied the best strategy to each deal that we thought. So we did a syndication and a tenant in common.
That's interesting. And you had a separate loan on both properties?
Correct. Yep. Two separate loans. Yep.
And did they both close at the same time?
They did. Yeah. Okay. Yep. So they both closed at the same time. So it was one escrow, one purchase contract for two deals, but two separate loans, which was complicated. I mean, it's a lot of loan paperwork right at the end there, knocking all that stuff out.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the syndication piece, where did most of your passive investors come from? Were they, you know, friends and family? Were they, you know, people from your meetup group? Were they people from your mentorship group? Kind of what was the lay of the land? And how did that differ from what you expected? You know, you had your network in your head, you had an idea for certain people. I'm sure you had some faces in the back of your head that these guys are definitely going to invest. And what was the reality?
Yeah, great question. It's funny because, I mean, when you listen to the podcast, a lot of people will say like friends and family, you need to start with them, et cetera, et cetera. And then I joined this mentorship program. But the mentorship program is based in Texas. So we hardly had any investors invest in a Phoenix deal, surprisingly.
Wow. And I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we did not have a lot of equity and we don't get a lot of equity from the mentorship program. And I think it's just because it's Texas based.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not as interested or don't understand or don't, feel comfortable with
Phoenix.
Well,
also, I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, when you started doing deals in Arizona, you guys weren't, may not have been the first one in the group to do an Arizona deal, but you were still at the forefront. And, right. you know, just in my knowledge of that, over time, there's been more and more talk about Arizona being a good market for multifamily. So,
yep, I think so.
You know, I don't know if you saw on later deals a little bit more participation, but I would imagine, no?
We did not, no. We actually, we saw less actually. We got more
did
on
you
that
really?
First one. So to give you an idea, this is not the deal we're talking about, but the most, I mean,
Just pick a deal. Yeah. And kind of gives a feel for the investors.
We did a $6 million raise and 700K came from the group.
Wow.
Most of it was from like a coach in the group. So without him, there would have been almost no money from the group. So of the mentorship group. But to answer your earlier question, Darren, yeah, I mean, I was like, I got most of my money from people that I had met within the previous year at events and stuff. It was crazy. It was not mostly friends and family, because what I've learned is that a lot of friends and family don't feel comfortable investing because they don't want to cross those lines. This is just me, okay? And I don't feel as comfortable asking them either, because it's just like they know Zach, the healthcare guy, not Zach, the real estate guy. But it was a lot of the people that I had met at events and meetups and things like that. In the previous 12 months or so that ended up investing. And I only had one physician invest as well. So I personally raised 965K for that first deal, which was a blessing. I didn't expect that. But it was really just grinding. It was a grind, you know what I mean? To get to that point, because it was not quick. You know, it was like a lot of follow-up and things like that. But I mean, I've had repeat investors. And for us, we have not yet gone full cycle on a deal, meaning that we've purchased it, executed the business plan, and sold it. We probably would have by now, because we had almost a full offer price or a full price offer on our first deal, but then COVID hit. Right. But my point is, once you go full cycle, that's when you can prove the concept. And I think you can really start to raise more capital because investors see the track record. But yeah, for that first one, it was just kind of a culmination of a bunch of people I had met, not necessarily friends and family and not necessarily that mentorship group.
No, that's very, very interesting. So, and you know, that's probably one of the challenges of being in your 20s too, you know, for listeners is, you know, because people in their 20s typically don't have a ton of capital. You had a lot more capital than most people in their 20s. And so you're looking at people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s to actually invest in the deal. And so how does a 20 something, you know, provide the credibility, you know? And
correct, exactly.
You know, a number of different ways to do that is, you know, one, you were very successful in your career prior to that. So that's one way to leverage it. Two is to leverage all the partners. And, you know, so I think you mentioned his name was Tom, you know, your first partner, you know, he was an experienced guy talking about other people that are involved in the deal and that have looked at the deal and that have blessed the deal. And that, you know, that helps provide the credibility. I actually had, you know, my wife said on our first syndication deal, do not go to the personal network.
Yeah, there you go, right?
And I was like, well,
lose their money. Yeah.
She was like, well, what if it doesn't work? And I told her, look, I'm not wired that way. The way I'm wired is, hey, we're putting our money in it and everything I put my mind to, like, I find a way to be successful. Not that there's not going to be hiccups along the way,
right?
But you just have to work through them, right? So I was convinced of the deal. And so I'm like, why am I not going to present that to friends and family? But the interesting part of that was there were certain people that I thought for sure would invest. And when I approached them, you know, wealthy people,
yeah,
they're like, hey man, Darren, I'm sorry, but I just bought this other company. or we just had to put a big capital infusion into one of my companies. Like the timing was just off.
Excuses. They probably had a bunch of cash, right, Darren? And they're just
right. That's what they told me.
They want to make sure you prove yourself first.
That very well could be it. Like, all right, well, you know what? I like Darren, but let me see if he succeeds on this one, and then we'll come back on the second one. But then there were other people that there was one person in particular that I'm like, I'm not going to even text this person. And that person, and I finally did. And that person said, let's meet up for coffee. Let me understand this. I don't understand it, but let me understand it. And then afterwards was like, thank you so much for bringing that opportunity to me. You know,
you would never know, right? Yeah.
Would never know. So it's very hard to, I think as a syndicator or, you know, fundraising for capital like this, you could self-judge other people that, you know, this person would be interested and this person wouldn't, but you could guess wrong. So, you know, present the opportunity. And if they're not interested, you just move on to the next one.
100%. And you said it very well, Darren, is that you have to think of it. You can't think of it as asking people for money, right? You don't want to seem desperate. You are presenting an opportunity to them. And if they want to invest, great. And if they don't, internally, you can think, okay, it's your loss, right? I mean, you don't feel like you're asking for money. Yeah. And to your point too, there's probably a lot of people that as you're trying to get into it, you talk to different people and you want to try to get like a rough idea or an abstract idea of a soft commit list, right? You're like, okay, I've talked to this person, this person, this person. They said they would do it. And then like you said, when the time comes, a lot of those people bail, right? And they don't actually do it. So you just never know. And it's a lot harder than you would think.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. So Zach, I'm gonna kind of flip the switch a little bit and just go back. You mentioned your childhood briefly, that you didn't grow up with a lot of money, but you know, just fill us in a little bit about you said you were raised in Phoenix, you know, not wealthy, you know, rich, poor, middle class. You know, what was your upbringing like? Just give us a little feel for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I was born in Phoenix. And then a few months after I was born, we moved to Colorado Springs. That's where my dad's side of the family is from. And I lived there. We moved back to Phoenix till I was like 6 or 7. So everything I pretty much remember was Phoenix. I lived in Colorado for a little bit. But yeah. I mean, my dad was like a painter. My mom worked in like HR. So we were not like poor or anything like that. I don't want to be dramatic. We were just like lower middle class. And I can remember, I don't know, I was in elementary school. I can remember like my parents, it always seemed like money was hard to come by, right? I can remember them filing for bankruptcy. And then I can remember bankruptcy talk again in high school. So I think it was twice they had filed for bankruptcy. And I know
did that influence you?
It influenced me in the sense that I was always ambitious. Like I just remember at a young age, like I liked to play Monopoly a lot. And I just like, I liked the idea of making money, you know what I mean? And building stuff and selling. And when I graduated high school, I was so motivated to go and get my degree because you're just trained, you know, in order to get a good job and make good money, right. Go to college. And so in college, I got a 4.0 and I'm not
did you really?
Yeah. I graduated with a 4.0. I did not get a B in 4 years, like over 50 classes. I got all A's and it's because I wanted to like push myself, you know? And so anyways, I was motivated to make money because I didn't want to have to ever feel like I was left without, you know what I mean? And so, but yeah, so I basically grew up in Phoenix. I played a lot of sports. I was always into sports and then played high school football, did well with that.
So as a child, was there any time that you can think of that you could actually picture yourself there? I'm going to be successful.
Yeah.
And you know, what did that look like? And what does success look like to you at that early childhood age that kind of had that inner core drive for you going forward?
Yeah, that's a good question, Darren, because I don't really think about it, but you asking that just brought back like a memory. I would always like think of myself, and maybe this was for movies, but I would always think of myself as an adult when I was a kid as like wearing a suit and standing like at the top level of a skyscraper, looking out, kind of like at New York City, like something like that. That's what I would imagine myself, like the top story looking out. And
that's very, very cool. So I as a kid, I don't know why Fortune magazine, but I always thought of myself as I'm going to be on Fortune magazine someday.
That's
what
cool.
What that means, I don't know. But like, you know, I'm always interested to talk to people about that question, because I think that whether it's going into business for yourself or getting a 4.0 or getting into real estate or doing something you haven't done before, that it first starts with a decision and drive. And you had that drive early on, and you knew you wanted something different. You weren't really sure what it was, but you were going searching for it.
Yeah, you have to have that fire. And I remember when I quit football, it was a really tough decision, because in football, you're just trained to be mentally tough and not make excuses. And you play through pain and you play through injuries and you just grind. And when I quit, I had a lot of guilt because I felt like I was quitting prematurely. And so I told myself, I'm not going to get a B the rest of school. I just told myself, I'm not going to get any B's. And that's what motivated me, you know. And then I was very introverted as a kid. I was very like insecure, introverted naturally.
Are you kidding me? So first of all, you tell me you were a tackle, which you don't look like an offensive tackle. And then you say you were introverted, and you are incredibly outgoing every time I see you. So
I was very introverted. Yeah, I was very introverted all throughout high school, very quiet, like the hard worker, quiet type of kid. And I wanted to like prove it and walk the walk, not talk the talk. And then when I was going to journalism school, that applying to be in a program and be on TV was the most terrifying thing, being on live TV. And every time we would go live, because it's broadcasting to like millions of households. Granted, probably nobody watched it, but still, you know, it's like, it's Arizona PBS. And so my palms would get all sweaty every time, and I was terrified. But you learn how to fake it until you make it, right? You learn how to, you learn how to not show nervousness and kind of push through it. And it just gave me more confidence. And then after that, I go into marketing, which was really not my natural thing. And that gave me more confidence. I just kept pushing my comfort zone. And so that's been my goal, is continue to strive for fear. And that's part of the meetup too, Darren. Like, people have asked me lately, like, why do you do the meetup? I was like, honestly, we're trying to just make it bigger, and I'm just trying to do scary stuff because it gives you more confidence later on.
That's a perfect segue. So I want to talk about fear. You know, that fear stops so many people from getting into real estate, you know, it. And so, you know, you did a lot of different things that you had to fight through the fear. You know, you did football, then you went into school, and then you were in different career paths, and then you know, decided to change and go after real estate. And then you had to call brokers and lenders, and all these people are much older than you are. And so there's a lot of fear in all those different steps. And then you had to raise money. You know, how do you get through the fear? How do you push yourself when you're afraid? You said a lot of times during this conversation, I was scared, you know, there was fear. Well, I didn't, you know, in broadcasting, it was going to be on TV. My hands were sweating. How did you push past that fear?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, it can paralyze you and stress you out. And you just kind of have to get to the point. I mean, for me, for real estate, I had kind of quote unquote burned my ships behind me, right? Like they say in Think and Grow Rich, like I had quit the job. I was making no money. I couldn't go back to it. So I couldn't just quit and bail. There were a lot of days where I did want to quit, or I just didn't do anything productive that day. You know what I mean? Because I was just like nervous or whatever. But you get to the point where you're just like, well, screw it. I have nothing to lose. And so you kind of have to just learn that you're not really failing unless you don't try. And you cannot be afraid to fail. You have to just kind of put yourself out there, and it's just getting through it. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do. It's just deep breaths, like deep breaths through your nose and exhale slowly through your mouth, you know? So, and people can't notice, they don't notice that. And you have to just kind of develop in real estate. What I tell people is you have to develop like a relentless warrior mindset where you don't care what other people think and you don't care what they say. And that includes your own family, maybe your parents, your loved ones, because a lot of people told me I couldn't do it. And they'd like, what are you doing? Like, you just quit $200K a year. And now you're not doing anything. You haven't made money in like 10 months and you're burning through savings. And you have to get to the point where you're like, screw it. I don't care what you say. And you don't have to be rude or malicious, but you say, screw you and screw you in your mind. And it's okay to have a chip on your shoulder and use that to motivate you and kind of prove people wrong. And you can do that in a humble, respectful way. But it just, you have to kind of put yourself at that point where it's good to take on adversity. And you just have to, you have to put yourself out there and not be afraid to fail. And you can't worry about what people think, because it definitely doesn't matter anyways.
It's that, so many great points there. I mean, so much good advice there. You said one thing that reminded me of something that happened with me. I was in a training program for institutional trading, and I don't know, there were six or eight of us in that, and one of the girls came from a different division of the bank that I was working for, and she said to me, "Darren, what are you going to do if this doesn't work out?" And kind of like you, like, you know, I had taken a, you know, big, not a pay cut, but my guarantee pay went down significantly, but the opportunity was significantly better. Right. And I said to her, "I just don't think that way. I'm thinking, what do I have to do to make it work? I see the guys, I've met the guys that are on the trading desk, and I know what they make, and why not me?" And that's what, you know, I think that so many people have to put in their head is, why not me? You know, it, instead of, I can't do it, or there's all these challenges, and you had that mindset, you know, that, yeah, I might be scared, but look, I'm hungry, man, and I'm going to figure this thing out.
You have, yeah, exactly, Darren. You have to get into the mindset that you have nothing to lose, okay? Because even if, let's say you fail and you lose all your money, it doesn't mean you can't restart back. And it's like, what are you going to fall to? If you fall, you're going to fall to where you just were. And if you weren't happy where you were, then what does it matter?
Right.
You know, like I knew I could go back into hospice and go make money if I lost all my money, but I would hate doing that. I'd rather be broke and try to survive pursuing a bigger dream with more upside in my passion than be comfortable doing something I am not happy, knowing that I'm not fulfilling my true potential.
And you're only in your 20s. Look, I just turned 50. And I know a lot,
prime man.
and I know a lot of people that get caught up in the, you know, they start working, they get the raise, they get the bonuses, and what do? They buy the nicer car, they buy the house, they get married, and now all of a sudden they're a slave to their mortgage and their car payments.
Yep.
And they're not happy. They're successful because they're climbing the corporate ladder per se, but they're not happy. And when they look at alternatives, they feel like they're trapped because they can't go backwards, you know, where, you know, you took, you know, savings, put it aside. And I would imagine you probably lived your life pretty frugally at that stage. You know, when
100%, yeah. I cut. So one good point to that point, I forgot to mention. So when I was 18, I read Dave Ramsey's book, Total Money Makeover, I think, whatever one of his books, but it just kind of trained my mind to kill debt, right? And live frugally, which I think is a good mindset when you're trying to kill debt. I do not think Dave Ramsey is a good strategy when you're trying to build wealth, when you're debt free.
Right.
But it gave me the good mindset.
Well, you know, the difference between good debt and bad debt, right? I mean, bad debt being you're buying stuff for your personal, it's not going to make you any money, versus good debt, you know, on cash flowing properties, that's going to produce excess cash for you. That's different, that you're able to leverage that. So
100%.
What do you do outside of business? What's your passions outside of business?
I'm pretty boring, Darren.
Come on, you are not boring.
No, I don't. So okay, so
you're 100% business all day long.
I like to work out. So I work out every morning. I do like home workouts, like Monday through Friday, and then I go to the gym like Saturday, Sunday, Monday night. And I try to spend quality time with Grace.
Grace is your fiance. When are you guys getting married, by the way?
In October. About October. 4 months.
Oh, I didn't even know the answer, and I may have put you on the spot there. If you didn't have a date, you may have been in the doghouse, but you do. Okay.
Yeah, no, we're ready. Yeah, we're good to go. It's all lined up. It's not being affected by COVID. Yeah.
So you guys also, I've seen your posts on social media. You travel some, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We have traveled a little bit. I don't really like to travel that much. Grace does. But we went to Europe a couple years ago for like 3 weeks. Drove me crazy. It was like too long. I don't like to, I'm all about routines. I'm very habitual and routine, and things like that. But yeah, we went to Hawaii for her birthday last year. So yeah, we'll travel when we can. Yeah. So real estate, I left hospice, went into real estate, Darren. And then it was just getting slow. I was getting bored, honestly. I was going crazy. Because once I learned how to do the real estate and the infrastructure was built out and I had my partners in place and we were very cohesive. I mean, a couple months go by and we just can't find a deal. I don't have anything to do.
Right.
So I had a non-compete that had run out from my previous hospice. I had a good opportunity to become a president and owner of a hospice organization. And I actually started that in October of 2019.
Oh, wow. So now I didn't even know that.
I'm full-time hospice and real estate.
Wow, now, I didn't know that.
And I have the time. And so now I have, and it's nice because now I have like a high salary. I have more liquidity. And now I actually have more fun doing both because I'm just time blocking my time and I'm flexible. You know what I mean? So we've got 75 employees. I'm in the office in the morning in the field and we make it happen. So I'm going like 100 miles an hour, but I really like it and I like to keep it structured.
That's awesome. So for the younger investors, say 20s, early 30s investors, what's your advice to becoming successful in large scale multifamily as a young person?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, there's a lot of things. I think the biggest thing you kind of touched on it, Darren, is you have to overcome the fear and you have to truly believe that you can do it. Okay. There's nothing special about me. You don't have to quit your job in order to do it, but you can't waste time. Like if you have a full-time job, you need to learn about this stuff by listening to podcasts like yours, Darren, and reading books and meeting with people and going to events. So stop watching Netflix and stop getting on Facebook and you need to cut out all that time and use it as productive time. And you have to start to educate yourself. It'll give you confidence to speak the lingo and make you feel like you belong. And then you'll start to gain confidence. Like, okay, I understand how it works. I see other guys doing it. I met this guy, he can do it. And then you need to identify what type of value can you bring to a team. Okay. Because you have to partner with people. Even if you're very smart and you have a lot of money, doesn't matter. You still need partners. So what is your passion and what are you most proficient at and what are you weak at? And try to find complementary partners who have strong work ethic, who you get along with. And who are committed, who have complementary skill sets. So it's really, you have to gain the confidence, gain the knowledge, and it's not rocket science either. Like you can learn how this stuff works. These are not complex businesses. You just need to understand it, gain the confidence, and then find the business partners, and then just focus on the first deal. It does not need to be 100 units. Even if it's 5 units, 10 units, just do the first deal. You'll get a lot of confidence and you'll feel like you're like in the club. And then you can find other people to partner with. Okay, I just talked to a guy today. He reached out to me. And he has over 500 units here in Phoenix. And he's asking me now if he can partner with us to bring like 15 to 20 million for institutional capital. Okay. So
amazing.
We need to syndicate it. We just need to find the deal and he'll bring institutional capital. And it's just because we've proved the concept, you know, and it started with a 36 unit deal that we all put our own money into. And so you just need to gain confidence, find the right business partners, because then you have your infrastructure down. Right? Like I don't need to spend all this time like I did initially to find deals because we know what we need to do, you know, and we have systems in place.
Right. So a lot of that was educating yourself and building relationships with partners. And I think that in today's market, you have to if you're a new guy and you want to get into larger scale multifamily, you have to partner with somebody that has already done it.
Yep.
But the other piece of that is at some point, you know, there's always another podcast, there's always another book, there's always another deal you can underwrite. At some point, you got to pull the trigger and take action. And yep. You talked about early on in this discussion that you were, you know, you saw this mobile home park and it actually was a good deal, but you had, you know, you just couldn't get over actually putting an offer on it. You just were scared. And yep. At some point, even though you were scared, you actually took action and went after that first multifamily deal. So those are the two components I think that, you know, anybody needs to have is that one, get educated, But at some point, you could always get more educated, right? At some point, you gain a certain level of knowledge. You just got to take action. And that can be scary, but you got to do it.
Yeah, and you will gain the confidence as you go. It's like the analogy, if you're going to drive from California to New York, you can't see in the middle of the night, you can't see the road in front of you, right? You can only see X amount of feet in front of you. But when you get to the next step, you'll figure out the next step and the next step and so on and so forth. And so, I mean, just calling that mobile home park owner, Darren, I was terrified. I was like going to hyperventilate, just calling him. And he's like, oh, it's already sold. And then I like click, hang up. And I'm like, I feel confident. I called him at least. You know what I mean?
Right. Now, if you were to call a mobile home park owner now, you would not feel the same way.
Not at all. No, I'd feel calm. I would probably try to smooth talk them and try to negotiate the deal. Right. You know?
It's just because you've done it, you know?
Yeah, it's like anything. It's like anything, and you have to do it. Sending the first offer, the first LOI was so scary. We weren't even close. And so they say, oh, you're not even close. Well, then you're like, okay, well, now I sent one at least. Like, at least I feel good. We sent an offer. Like, right. We're for real, yep. You know? So it's just anything.
So Zach, you know, if there's anybody on the listening that has interest in becoming a passive investor, has never done it before, doesn't know how to go about it, you know, how do they get involved?
Yeah, good question. So I think with passive investors, you have to be careful because you want to identify sponsors who are experienced, right? And now in the days of social media, it's like everybody's on a podcast is an instant expert, and they look like they're really prolific, but maybe their deal's not performing. So I mean, joining a mentorship group, I think, is extremely valuable. I mentioned to you that we have not raised a lot of equity, but I don't regret it at all. I dropped $30,000 to join a mentorship group, and I met almost all my business partners through there, and it's really just helped accelerate my path. And so I think going to meetups, joining a mentorship group, you need to get in contact with people who are doing deals and experienced sponsors and just start to pick their brain. And you don't need to, if you just want to be passive, you don't need to feel intimidated or dumb by not knowing about it, because people, the sponsors should be selling it to you, right? They're the ones trying to make it appealing to you. And so you can feel free to question people. And so I think you just need to get out there and you need to network with people. You're not going to find deals Googling, you know, because you can't. It's illegal for these 506Bs. You can't market them. So join a mentorship program, go to meetup events, get out there and network and get on phone calls. And just start to ask people, like, how does this work? What's minimum investment? Things like that. And if you can identify other passive investors, then you need to ask them as well.
That great, great, great advice. So when you go on those conferences, to those meetups, and you meet other syndicators, you know, exchange business cards. You'll get on their investor database. And when they have another opportunity, they'll present you with the opportunity. You do not have to invest. But at least you'll see you'll be able to participate in a webinar if you want to. And I would encourage you to do that. And you'll start educating yourself on how these deals are put together and how the sponsors answer questions. So how do they present the deal? What's their business plan? And then typically at the end of a webinar, there'll be a lot of Q&A and you'll hear some of the other questions and you'll learn from that. And then, you know, once you participate in a number of those, you start to feel like, hey, this is a person I think I might want to do business with, or this is a person I think I might want to do business with, and I want to get to know them better. So then you set up a phone call, or if you're local, you get together at a Starbucks for coffee and get to know them better. So you want to know who you're doing business with. So 100%. With that, so this guy is a go-getter. He's in the Phoenix market. If you want to invest in Phoenix, you have to look him up. You have to go to his meetup group because he's got a ton of value. You will meet other syndicators. You will meet other passive investors. And you'll also meet lenders and insurance people and brokers and all kinds of different people that he brings to add value to everybody that comes to these meetups. Zach, how do people reach out to you if they want to get in touch with you?
Yeah, thanks so much, Darren. So yeah, you can email me. It's Zach, Z-A-C-H, at zhmultifamily.com. No hyphens or anything. And we can set up a call. You can go to our website, zhmultifamily.com, and there's like a little contact us, little blurb you can fill out and we'll reach out to you. or feel free to text me and I'll get back to you in 2 or 3 days and we can set up a call. My cell phone is 602-859-5458. You can text me, say, hey, I listened to you on Darren's podcast. I want to jump on a call, and I'm happy to get on a call and share value however I can.
Well, Zach, I really appreciate you being on. And if I'm in Phoenix, next time I'm in Phoenix, I will definitely be looking you up for sure. I look forward to seeing you again here in Dallas at some point. And you just never know. Hopefully we partner on a deal at some point.
You never know. Yeah. Thanks so much, Darren. Thanks for having me on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed that one. Look, you young people, 20s, 30s, I wish I had started this 20, 30 years ago. And Zach, it just showed you how you can do it. So hope you enjoyed that one. Until next week, signing off.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you. And please share the show with a friend.